Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be discussing President Trump's arrival on the world stage. We'll also be looking at the problem of medicating adult ADHD sufferers. And finally, we'll be speaking about virtual reality headsets and whether they're about to change the way we think and work. In this week's cover story, Professor Andrew Bacevich looks ahead to Trump's presidency and suggests that we are in for a very wild ride. On foreign policy, Trump will either win big or destroy decades of American doctrine. He joins me now, along with our deputy editor, Freddie Gray, to discuss what will happen when Trump takes charge. So, Andy, you mentioned that Trump's uniquely unpredictable. Is there anything we can predict at this stage?
Well, I think that he'll probably use the first-person singular pronoun more frequently than any president that we've had in the last century or so. Presidents tend to speak in the first-person plural, you know, we. But not Trump. It's all about him.
And Freddie, in Andrew's piece, he suggests that Trump isn't really committed to globalism. How's that going to pan out?
Well, I think it'd be very interesting to see. I think that in a sense, he's a continuation of Obama, as Andy says in his excellent piece, in that the sort of idea of American leadership in the world is on the retreat in America. But in other ways, he's obviously very different. I mean, he's a sort of negative Obama, and I don't necessarily mean negative in a negative way. Whereas Obama was about sort of global healing and bringing the world together, Trump is a businessman first and foremost, and he'll just look at America's national interests much as a businessman would look at the interests of his company abroad.
But is it really possible to untangle America's relationships with all of these other countries?
It'll be very difficult. And I think there's already areas where we're seeing Trump will be a much more predictable Republican than we might have expected. I think perhaps Andy will be much better on this than me, but in the relationship with Israel, he seems to be very, very close to the largest or most prominent supporters of Israel in American politics. Is that right, Andy?
Well, I think so. His selection to be the U.S. ambassador to Israel, he's picked this gentleman named Friedman, who is himself a generous supporter of the settlement expansion on the West Bank. And for those, and I would include me in the group, who believe that settlement expansion makes the two-state solution ever more difficult to implement, that's a troubling development. But to go back a little bit, you know, I suggest in the article that Obama's policies have seen something of a backing away from American globalism. But perhaps to clarify that a little bit, it's been a backing away from a globalism that puts the use of American military power at the absolute forefront. Obama, to his credit, I believe, has been very at the forefront of trying to address global issues such as climate change. And that's where Freddie's point, I think, is quite apt. Trump being a business executive first and foremost, you know, sort of what's in it for me, how much am I going to have to pay, preoccupied with near-term benefits, is likely to look at something like the Paris climate deal and say, well, the heck with that. And so his version of globalism, if we want to call it that, is going to be more confrontational, demanding, focused on near-term benefits. And if that doesn't pay off, then it seems to me his great unpredictability could lead to a radical shift in U.S. policy away from globalism toward what I don't know, but towards something that'll be radically different from what the role we've come to expect the United States to play basically since World War II.
And of course, this is bad news, certainly in the short term, for a country like Britain, isn't it? Because we, for a rather a long time, have been enjoying a sort of free ride on America's generosity and defense spending and so on.
Well, I you know, it's not for me to give advice to the British government, but I would think that within the cabinet, particularly those officials concerned with foreign policy, national security issues, there ought to be some sort of conversation going on about what can we Brits do to deflect this growing emphasis on free riding as a problem. What can we do to demonstrate to President Trump that the special relationship deserves to be preserved? I don't know quite what the answer would be, but I think that would be something that in Great Britain, in the UK, people would want to be thinking about.
Well, I think the answer is obvious, but I think our government are probably too Trump-phobic to even tolerate the idea. Trump has said before how much he loves the pomp and the circumstance of Britain and the British monarchy. I think his mother was a huge fan of it. I mean, I think the thing to do would be to sort of send him over here, flatter him like crazy, and introduce him to the Queen. But I don't think we'll do it.
Well, I mean, perhaps you're making a good argument. He does seem to be a guy who is easily seduced by superficial, you know, expressions of regard. But I would personally think that a better approach might be to take another look at the UK's defense budget and consider increasing it rather than decreasing it, which, as far as what I can see, is what's been happening over the past a quarter century or so.
That would be a good idea if we had any money at all.
And Andy, in your piece, you talk about the security team that Trump's starting to surround himself with and how it's going to matter more than usual who's in it. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, what the most striking thing to me, I think, is the prominence of generals. Trump ran saying, elect me president, I will drain the swamp, I will kick the establishment out. Generals are members of the establishment, and we're going to have a general running the Pentagon, a general running our Department of Homeland Security, a general running the National Security Council, and another general advising the general running the National Security Council. So we've got more generals in more prominent places, nominally civilian positions, than we will have had in any previous administration. And what exactly that means, I don't know, but it will be very interesting to see.
Again, I think that speaks to Trump's superficiality. I mean, I think he just cares a lot about what people wear. So, I mean, a guy in a uniform always impresses him.
I suspect you're right, Freddie. And, you know, by the time you get to be a 3 or 4 star officer, you become skilled, I think, at presenting yourself. And these guys do present well. And I think you're exactly right. That makes an impression on somebody like Trump. And he just suddenly decides he wants to have a bunch of generals working for him.
Because if I remember rightly, in the build-up to the Iraq War, part of the Bush administration's strategy was to get as many generals wearing military uniform on TV as possible, making the case for the Iraq War.
Oh, that has become one of the more, in my mind, distressing trends in American politics. Really, both parties are equally guilty. Every time we have a presidential election these days, each party tries to trot out as many generals and admirals on their side, as if that demonstrates that the party itself and the party's nominee somehow can be trusted with the security of the nation. It's first of all, that's not persuasive. And secondly, the effect has been to politicize the American military in ways that I think can be profoundly negative.
And Freddie, it's interesting this phrase, drain the swamp, that Andy just mentioned. Is that going to be possible to do?
Well, drain the swamp was this sort of Trump slogan about getting rid of all the terrible people in Washington who are bringing the country down. And having lived in Washington, I can say on foreign policy, it is a bit of a swamp. There's a lot of think tankers and sort of false prophets of American foreign policy who get paid a lot of money to come up with very bad and disastrous ideas that have been very damaging to America. But I think they will be on the way out because I don't think Trump or his circle have much time for them. What they are replaced with is a more difficult question to answer. It could be something even worse.
And Andy, just finally, we've on our cover this week, we've depicted Trump riding the Twitter bird, like the David painting of Napoleon. Do you think Trump is expected to govern via Twitter? He seems to have been doing that a bit so far.
Well, first of all, he shows no signs of suppressing his inclination to govern through Twitter. So I think we have to expect that to happen. I expect that we're going to have 4 years of him popping off at 3 o'clock in the morning. And the next day, when people show up to work, his spokespersons will have to explain what he really meant and back away from it. And I personally think that that is likely to produce disastrous results. It is a version of one man rule at a time when I think I don't know who is smart enough to govern the planet alone. I'm pretty sure that Trump is not smart enough to govern the planet on his own.
You don't think it might reach some point where it's sort of nobody takes it seriously? Trump's Twitter account is...
I think that's the optimistic interpretation. that the government of the People's Republic of China, the government of the United Kingdom, the government of Saudi Arabia will learn to take these tweets with a grain of salt, and they'll decide to wait until the spokesperson the following day explains what Trump really meant and have that be the authoritative statement of U.S. policy. I hope that will turn out to be the case.
That was Andrew Bacevich and Freddie Gray. For more American coverage in the run-up to Donald Trump's inauguration, do subscribe to our Americano podcast hosted by Freddie. In this week's issue, Elisa Seagrave writes about a medication called atomoxetine, which her son was taking to treat ADHD. It drastically changed his behaviour, and while he loved it, the medication changed his life for the worse, says Elisa. I'm joined now by Elisa, along with Professor Philip Asherton from King's College London, to discuss this medication. So Elisa, what happened?
Well, my son, I was pretty certain, had many years had wanted to go back onto a form of Ritalin, which he'd had when he was about 14 or 15, when he'd been at a special school for O-levels, and it had made him concentrate. He'd liked the effect of it, but he wasn't on it very long. But for many years, on and off, he tried to get an equivalent Ritalin-type drug for adults. And he must have realised the way to get this was to pretend he had ADHD. He probably read about it and so on. And the small care team who were working with him part-time cooperated with this, you know, because obviously they respected his wishes and so on. And he went to a psychoanalyst who he'd already been a patient of several years earlier, who was very, very good, very specialised in medication, etc. And he, with the NHS psychiatrist, where my son lived in Brighton, put him on this atomoxetine, and unfortunately it made him completely manic, but he loved being on it and he wouldn't go off it.
And how did this behaviour manifest itself?
All sorts of ways. He couldn't listen to anyone. I mean, he's already got Asperger, and you know, they're very obsessive often, very obsessive. This was far worse. He was determined to do what he wanted. He was like somebody on speed. People who'd been very kind to him, like his godmother, often had him to stay in Somerset in her village. All the villagers had been very nice to him. She said she could never have him again while he was on this, because he was completely intractable. He was getting his own, trying to get his own way all the time. He was talking at people very, very fast. And he'd rushed into, she'd taken him to a charity event. He'd rushed into the ladies and started haranguing this poor woman she'd taken as a guest who was terminally ill. This kind of thing.
And Philip, your area of specialism is ADHD. Does this fit with the sort of thing that you've seen with this drug?
I think this, what I would call a manic reaction to the medication he took, atomoxetine, is very unusual. I wouldn't like to say it's altogether unexpected, because we know that antidepressants, and atomoxetine isn't a stimulant drug like Ritalin. It has a chemical effect in the brain which is more closely aligned to antidepressants, and we know that antidepressants can sometimes trigger mania. I mean, most usually in people who have some kind of propensity towards mania or depression. So I would say, at least in terms of the use of atomoxetine for treating ADHD, it's obviously something that has happened. It obviously is something that can happen, but I think it's quite an unusual, I would say rather rare event in this case.
Was the fact, though, that my son actually doesn't have ADHD, would that have made any difference to his reaction of the drug?
I don't think it was bad luck. I think it was just bad luck. And of course, it may indicate something else about him, which we don't, you know, which is probably hard to understand. I mean, people have these individual reactions to drugs.
Yes.
But it does seem to suggest that if he's got any propensity towards depression or mania, that this drug sort of triggered that off one reason or another. But I think overall it's quite a rare event. So, for example, if you look at the clinical trials with atomoxetine, these kind of reactions haven't been reported. And certainly if this should be reported, I mean, if it has occurred, of course, it should be reported
as
a rare event.
Yes, maybe other people had the same reaction.
No, I agree.
Well, I was surprised because I looked it up and it didn't seem to have the properties of Concerta and Adderall and Ritalin.
Yeah, they're rather different. So with the stimulant drugs like Ritalin, you have these very immediate short-term effects. So, for example, when your son took Ritalin when he was younger, it would have had a very rapid effect in improving his concentration, sort of helping him work, for example. But those effects only last a few hours and then kind of wear off.
Oh, I
see. And the
see.
Drug comes out of the system very quickly. So sort of paradoxically, those drugs, stimulant drugs, may be safer because they clear out of the system so quickly.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. Because actually, my son's a painter and he sold several, had two exhibitions, and he was so manic on this atomoxetine, he didn't even really concentrate on painting. He was kind of speeding away all the time.
And Elisa, in the piece you mentioned that the psychiatrist now won't allow him back onto the drug. Have they sort of admitted that they got it wrong, or is it just...
They haven't actually admitted it. They've admitted... I wasn't accusatory, but I did ask the older man, why he'd put him on it. But from what you've just said, it seems perhaps, it was a perfectly normal choice to try it out. But he wouldn't go off it. He kept cancelling the appointments with the NHS psychiatrist. He knew he was going to be taken off it. He loved being on it. And then finally, the crisis team had to be called in, the NHS crisis team. For 3 months they were coming in. And he is now not taking any medication at all. And he's with a new team and they're trying out how he's going to be with this. It's been for several weeks. He's had no medication.
Is it normal for adults not to be prescribed Ritalin and to have other drugs?
Well,
instead?
It's interesting that because I don't know this case at all. I mean, I've not met him. And I suppose his psychiatrist obviously thought he had ADHD as well as Asperger's. And of course, we do know that people with Asperger's, are prone to ADHD. Certainly not everyone with Asperger's has ADHD, but many, many do.
Mm.
So it could be that he had some problems concentrating. I don't know if that was an issue for him. Maybe he had a very scattered kind of mind or couldn't focus easily on one thing at a time.
Well, he can concentrate very, very well if he wants to on things that are important. Like he dropped his mobile phone into one of two drains in Bognor a couple of summers ago. And we'd spent nearly 3 hours because we had to dredge mud out of the drains because we weren't sure which drain had gone into. They were next to each other. But he was determined not to give up. People came and helped us, children, retired gardeners, builders. Yeah. Everyone said, look, there's no point going on. Your phone's going to be ruined. No, my son was absolutely determined.
Yeah.
He got it back. The old retired gardener brought round a hoe from his house round the corner and we scraped the thing up and on it went. He got it back and nearly all the numbers are still on it.
And now,
so he will focus on something he really wants to do.
And I think that actually, curiously, it can be one of the characteristics of ADHD, but it might be even more pronounced with Asperger's, because people with Asperger's can be very kind of persistent.
That's right.
When they think something's important.
That's right.
But in ADHD, the concentration problem is usually for things that are kind of more boring, mundane, everyday tasks, or things that aren't immediately rewarding and stimulating. So something very important and essential, people with ADHD often can focus on. And so when people take medication for ADHD, it's often helping them focus on things which are a little bit more boring, like reading a book or doing exams or sort of sitting in a class and listening, those kind of activities.
That's very interesting.
It's interesting you get people with ADHD who are great sportsmen, for example, or great stage actors, because there's something very exciting about those scenarios and they function very well in those, or they can function very well in those situations.
A friend of mine who was taught for a long time at a grammar school, old-fashioned grammar school down in Orpington, he had a boy with Asperger, this was some years ago, and I've heard other teachers say this, so the boy was very academic, but he would not concentrate on anything he didn't want to concentrate on. Very difficult for teachers. He would only do what really interested him.
Yes.
Although he had the academic
ability. That really can be one of the core problems in ADHD, and which can in itself be quite difficult, because a lot of everyday life, isn't that stimulating all the time.
And Philip, what advances are being made in treatment for ADHD and Asperger?
Well, there aren't any known medical treatments for Asperger's, so it's a neurodevelopmental condition, and really one's thinking about supporting somebody, trying to understand them, build on their strengths.
Yes.
But there isn't any medical treatment for Asperger's per se. But of course there might be for some of the problems that run alongside Asperger's, so for example if they're anxious or depressed or have ADHD. So obviously his psychiatrist thought he had a problem with ADHD. they could have chosen a stimulant medication, which he'd tried before, you know, hadn't caused this kind of adverse reaction.
Like Concerta, you mean?
Like Concerta.
I don't think he'd ever been, never been on Concerta.
And Concerta and Ritalin are essentially the same drug.
Yes.
They're both methylphenidate. The only difference is one is short-acting and one is a sustained-release preparation. But they're both methylphenidate. They're both the same drug.
Yes.
And they can both be used in children and adults, actually. So all the same drugs used to treat children for ADHD can also be used for adults with ADHD.
And Elise, obviously, yeah. Your son at the start of this year was on this medication. He's now not on this medication. Are you happier that he's not on it, even if he's not?
I'm absolutely relieved because he fell out with all sorts of people. I mean, it's already very difficult for Asperger to have friends because they bang on about the same thing. You know, people get very bored and exhausted by them banging on. And so all the people who had supported him, who were quite tolerant, you know, like his former teacher, former counsellor, his godmothers, nobody could stand being with him for more than a very short time. It was his own worst enemy being on this medication. So I'm very, very relieved. I'm not saying he's completely transformed, because he never will be.
That was Elisa Seagrave and Philip Asherson. In his column this week, Hugo Rifkin says that he's seen the future and it doesn't want to work. He was given a virtual reality headset by his father-in-law, and he's now here to discuss whether we should be delighted or petrified of this new technology. So Hugo, what was this present and how did it pan out over Christmas?
So virtual reality headsets used to be this incredibly expensive high-tech thing. And then a few years ago, somebody smart discovered that actually we all have mobile phones, we all have smartphones, and you can just pop them in front of your eyes and they become the screen. So they divide into two and you get proper 3D and they're just held by a sort of frame right in front of your eyes. So it was one of them. So I think they cost about 40 quid, although I wouldn't want to prejudge what my father-in-law paid for the Christmas present. But I think it was about that. And it's just a plastic thing.
And what can you see on them?
It depends what app you kind of download. You can go on a roller coaster. You can dive in a shark tank. You can do all kinds of stuff. And it's proper 3D and it's completely immersive. So you turn your head and you look around the room you're kind of virtually in. And it sounds like it ought to be gimmicky and rubbish. And the most alarming thing is it really isn't.
I mean, it all sounds quite good fun. In your piece, you suggest that it may not be the kind of greatest thing ever. Why is that?
Well, it is good fun, but it's really, really immersive. So there's this one game I've got on it. It's a kind of sort of Space Invaders game. And I was playing that a bit on Boxing Day. And what that meant was I put my headset on and then I put these big headphones on over it. And I sat on the sofa kind of looking around, tapping the side of my head, shooting these aliens. And I could have been anywhere. And to the rest of my family, I was just this sort of weird sort of hybrid technological thing sitting on the sofa doing things that they couldn't see that they'd never know about. And the thought I sort of approach in the piece is that at the moment we worry about, you know, families sitting around, everyone looking at their phones. But that's nothing. Because like if one day we're all actually in different worlds, we're actually sealed off, hearing different things, seeing different things. That's far, far worse than just staring at your phone all the time.
And how did your family respond to you being sat there with this headset on? Did they think it was cool?
Well, they sort of mocked me and ignored me. I mean, my kids love it. Actually, kids aren't meant to use it, I think, until they're about 13. I think it gives them motion sickness. But I tried it a little bit on mine, just by with Google. Like, if you use Google Street View, it just feels like being actually there.
Really?
So they found it very odd if you putting a headset on them and they were, like, transported to the street outside our house. In summertime, they find that really, really strange. But they're actually very keen to use it, but I'm not going to let them until they're about 21.
And in your piece, you suggest that there's a generational schism developing, and you suggest that you're sort of losing touch with what the younger generation feel. Isn't that something that all generations have always sort of felt?
Well, I don't know, to be honest. I think that's definitely happening right now because there have been such massive changes in how we live over the last sort of 20 years. I reckon there's actually quite a lot of similarities between, I mean, I was born in 1977, so I reckon there's quite a lot of similarities between people my age, maybe 5 years younger than me, and up to perhaps 30 years older than me, in that we've grown up in similar sorts of worlds, wanting the same things, with the same sort of things being achievable. And that's now incredibly different. You know, people spend their youth doing completely different things that we did not spend our youth doing.
Well, one thing that probably most people did in their youth was have lots of sex. And in your piece, you mention porn as an obvious trailblazer. Do you really think that this technology could replace sex?
Well, I mean, not this technology. Well, okay, so the two really interesting things about porn. Firstly, porn is a great technological canary. Things that work in porn end up working in society. So VHS was led by porn. You know, home video of most sorts was led by porn. Superfast broadband was led by porn. And there is vast amounts of work being done on porn in virtual reality. When you start talking about things like, you know, all over body, I mean, there are obvious squeamish problems. There are great articles we've written about this. There are obvious squeamish problems with sort of porn-based equipment. But there is huge amounts of work and huge amounts of money being thrown at this problem. Porn's just an example. When we have a situation where you can have a fully immersive world that is indistinguishable from the real world, then we have all kinds of social problems.
And a really interesting part of your piece is when you talk about this Princeton study, which found that more than a fifth of American men without degrees between the ages of 21 and 30 worked not one day in 2014. And then you suggest that it's often because they were playing computer games. So is there a correlation between those two things?
Well, that's actually from the study. I didn't have time to talk about the study. I wrote about the study in the Times when it came out last year sometime. If I get this right, just... So the headline figure was that a fifth of American men between 21 and 30 without degrees worked not one day that year. But they also found that cohort altogether, entirely, was working, I think, between a quarter and a third less than they had done 15 years earlier because they had better things to do. And yes, it very much suggested that the main thing they had to do that was better was playing computer games.
And so presumably as more and more people lose jobs to robots, do you think this is going to get worse as a problem?
I mean, yes, but it's not just about losing jobs to robots. It's about having better things to do than having jobs. So when people talk about this sort of technological future where robots do all the work and we all have a universal basic income and all that kind of stuff, we talk about it as happening as a result of kind of human obsolescence, right? That robots can do our jobs better and cheaper and we get left on the shelf and have to find other things to do.
Mm.
What interests me is the idea that it might not happen that way around. Perhaps long before we're obsolescent, we'll just go, you know what? Nah, I'm not going to do this. And we will survive on the absolute basic that we can and spend our times doing more engaging things than having jobs.
Do you think there's any way of incorporating the two things? I mean, when I was younger, we used to play Sims, which is basically quite dull game about sort of town planning. Do you think that there's any way that we can kind of incorporate virtual reality and, you know, a real job and bring the two together?
It's an interesting idea. I know I saw an interview with an Uber driver not that long ago who was saying that the way you really get Uber to work and make a lot of money at Uber is you treat it like a computer game, that you achieve your points and you work up to the next level. And you think of it exactly like you'd think of doing some probably really quite boring kind of driving simulation on an Xbox. So I'm sure there are bits of that. I mean, interestingly, I remember back at the time of, I think it was back at the time of the Iraq War, the American military experimented with using sort of 3D role-playing shooting games like Counter-Strike as recruiting tools. Yeah, I mean, there definitely are some ways in which that could be done, I'm sure.
And do you think one day we'll have your column brought to us in virtual reality? Do you think that's going to be the next step for The Spectator?
I don't know what that would mean. You'd have to see me writing it. It wouldn't be pretty.
That was Hugo Rifkind. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And you can also subscribe to our other shows, including our books podcast, where Sam Leith was in conversation with Michael Lewis, author of Moneyball and The Big Short, about his new book, The Undoing Project. And if you enjoy the podcasts, then why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on this week's podcast, as well as great pieces by Owen Matthews, Simon Barnes and Harry Mount. And we have a trial offer. You can get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening and do join us again next week.